Sam Whipsut.
I was telling you before I turned on the mics that some days when we come in to record these intros, I don't feel like I'm good at it. And other days I feel like I'm really great and engaging and funny and interesting.
What makes the difference between days, Sonny?
I'd never know. I mean, you don't know what causes it, but today's not a good day, so I'm apologizing beforehand.
That's what everyone wants to hear in good radio, where you apologize for being alive and for talking.
Welcome to the steer.
Sam Whips was super fun to interview. We caught him right before he read at Powell's from his new novel, Hark, which I just started reading. Sonny?
He's fantastic. I mean, when you first mentioned he's coming to town and we should try to get him, I was immediately intimidated and thought, there's no way in heck that
Why?
We'll, I don't know. I mean, he's a big deal and we're not, but you don't like that.
I mean, no,
we're a huge deal, obviously. But anyway, no, he did it, and he was incredibly down to earth and cool and nice. But I first got into him when his first book of short stories came out, which is basically the first big thing of his that came out.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 2000, and for some reason, when it came out, it felt to me like it had been out since the 80s, just because it seemed to be already so well established.
Hmm.
And something about it felt like when someone tells you about some great collection of stories that's 20 years old and you hadn't heard of it, and you read it and you're like, oh, this is amazing. It felt like that. And so I didn't know until I was researching before our interview that it's, I mean, maybe this makes me sound old, but 2000 still feels recent to me, even though it's 18 years ago.
19, if you go by the Gregorian calendar.
That's a good point. So in that way, he's a younger writer than I imagined. But, I mean, he has like 5 novels out and tons of stories. And
right. Things. I mean, I guess, so he published that collection of short stories, though, but one of the things doing research, too, Homeland, that mm-hmm. was his first novel, right?
His first novel after Venus Drive was The Subject Steve.
The Subject Steve. I mean, I read doing some research. I mean, that couldn't find a U.S. publisher. And then so he published it in Britain first, and then it really caught on in Britain. And mm-hmm. then he found a U.S. publisher. But, I mean, it's always interesting. You really liked those short stories. You thought that they were kind of like part of the contemporary landscape. And I think for aspiring writers or for anyone that you know, something can seem like it's always been there, but then it was hard for him to publish his first novel. So I think it's a success story in some ways too, because he is a big deal and I think he's a great writer. So it's deserved success, but that he couldn't, you know, this short story collection came out, then he couldn't find a U.S. publisher for his novel. It's just interesting.
Yeah. And then I hope I'm getting this wrong. His next book after that was Homeland, which I think someone, HBO or someone like that, hired him to translate that into a TV series, which he did called, oh, now I'm forgetting, People Town, Person Town? Oh, no, I should have looked this up.
He was in a band, Dung Beetle.
You're just changing the subject.
Yeah.
No, I'm trying to give the arc of his success, because that came out and it was good enough that it attracted, you know, studio people. And then The Ass came out and that got really big.
That was a big deal, yeah.
Anyway, but you mentioned Dung Beetle, and I want to say my favorite part about our interview with Sam is that he, from memory, having not sung for his band in 10 or 20 years.
No, more than 10. I would say like 20, it's 2019, I think almost 30 years.
I think they
early did. 90s, 94, 90, 93. I mean, it's a while now, yeah.
Yeah, I think they did some random reunion show like 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
Which okay. is the only reason. But regardless, he just pulled that out from mm-hmm. memory and sang some, or he didn't sing them, he recited them, but that was my favorite part of the interview.
Still impressive, yeah.
So anyway, I guess let's just let people hear it.
Sam Whipsut.
Sam. Welcome to the steer. Is that good?
Yeah, that's good. That's really kind of like
a good intonation.
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah.
So we might just start sort of anywhere.
Okay.
And Jeff, I'm afraid again, we don't have headphones. It's not that we don't have headphones.
Very disappointed.
It's that whatever. We'll talk about it later. He never gets headphones.
That's a terrible situation.
I know. Community radio.
We were gonna play a Dung Beetle song.
You have a Dung Beetle song?
Well, we have the song from the Half-Cocked soundtrack.
Okay.
The one that, is that fine?
Yeah, you can play that.
You won't, like, grow horns or something?
Well, but I mean, it's a past life. We don't want to.
Yeah, you can play it.
We won't necessarily play the whole thing. We might. Sonny, we talked about starting.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think that's James Murphy turning the knobs on this thing.
Yeah, that's what I read. Yeah. Do you want to hear giving the nod like that's enough.
I'm familiar with it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always.
I like the song, and that was always one of my favorite ones to play live.
I can imagine there's a mix of emotions that could make you uncomfortable or whatever. Revisiting.
There's nothing specifically about it. It's a past life, and it's that strange. Haunted feeling you get when you start remembering, it's not even the song or the band, you remember who you were then, what kinds of things you felt, and that's always very odd.
Yeah. What you said earlier, something was going on with the drummer. Can you tell us about that day or during the recording?
Well, he was just, I think that he was just having some problems getting a certain beat down in the chorus, and I'll leave it at that.
I was in a band in college, and I remember sometimes we would get frustrated that 4/4 time was difficult for our drummer.
Yeah, and I mean, I could do no better, or I was a lot worse. So it's not like I could do it myself. He was, and I think that there were times we had it when a guitar player was, you know, approached by people saying, you know, just get rid of those guys and be in our band, and everyone had that little moment, but. We were together because we were friends and because we liked doing it together. We weren't trying to be, you know, playing in stadiums or trying to have some huge career. We just wanted to go around to clubs and do our thing. So in the end, if it's about that, then you can't really get mad at the drummer or get mad at the guitarist or, God, I mean, all the stupid shit I did and the ways I messed it up. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
But you were somewhat serious, right? You went to New York. I mean, you were trying to kind of make it, right? Or
yeah, I think we just had a specific sense of, you know, what that meant for us, and for I think that meant getting on a cool label,
mm-hmm.
a cool independent label, and playing in largish clubs and having a sort of small devoted following. I mean, that's how I thought about it. That's what it looked like. I mean, to me, I guess at the time, I remember playing with the Jesus Lizard one time and thinking, like, they were amazing.
They were big.
Band.
Yeah, yeah.
They were big.
Right.
But even as they said at the time, I remember David Yao saying, we're not, you know, it's not like we're as big as Led Zeppelin. Like, that to them, that's what a big rock band
right.
was. And, like, the scope at that time felt a little different. And I guess this was, you know, a bit before Nirvana and all that too, but
it's like 92.
Yeah, I mean, that's I guess we started in around 90, and so I guess we watched all of that change. You know, the
right
that it become a big commercial,
sure,
profitable thing.
Yeah,
but at the time before that, I think the idea was you could if you, because we had our closest friends in another band. It was the band Six Finger Satellite,
mm-hmm.
in Providence, and they were signed to Sub Pop, and they worked that much, and they paid their rent, and they had their practice space, and they made their records, and it was, you know, that was the life, that was the goal, to be able to kind of mostly get by on your music and to be making something really strange and interesting that a lot of people could get into, but you know, you didn't dream of selling out Foxborough Stadium or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the dream that you can just survive off of it and just do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that carried over into my idea of what you wanted to do as a writer, too.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I wanted to actually ask about that, because as you were a... What was the thing where you went to the White House?
In high school.
I was a presidential scholar in the arts.
Presidential, which to me sounds... very A, regal, and B, what does that mean?
Well, I had never heard of it, but I guess I was a senior in high school, and a guy a year ahead of me had won this award and been able to go to, he was a painter, and he'd been able to go to Florida. They had mm-hmm. this thing, it was called Arts or something, and so he told me about it, and he said, you should do, they have writing, you should apply, and I did. It turned out that thing was a feeder into this presidential scholars thing. So you kind of went through these various stages. So the first thing is I was invited down to this kind of teen arts conference in Miami. And then from that group, a few were chosen to be, I'd never heard of it before, but I guess it was something that had been around for a while called presidential scholars. Most of the presidential scholars were academic.
Like Gideon and A+ and Trigg.
Exactly. And like they were, you know, and I think it worked like the Senate, like there were two from every state or something.
Okay. So it was pretty exclusive though.
And then they had this little kind of side group of artists. And so there were a couple actors and dancers and painters and a couple of writers. And we went down to DC and we got to sit on the White House lawn and, you know, Reagan gave a speech.
But you got this from fiction writing.
Yeah, I was writing short stories, and I wrote a play, too.
Okay, and, I mean, both your parents are writers, were writers.
Yeah.
And then, when you were in Dung Beetle, were you still writing seriously, or was it somewhat of a repudiation, kind of your destiny?
Definitely the latter. I was...
Oh, really?
I had kind of come to this place where I didn't know what I was doing as a writer. I was kind of sick of... that world, not that I really understood it, but I was 22. I'd been writing in college, but sort of kind of written myself into a corner. I fell in love with something that I could do with other people.
Mm-hmm.
I love the collaborative part of it. I was the lead screamer and lyricist, but
right.
But I really liked that, you know, the guitars mostly drowned out my lyrics when I was...
Took some pressure off the writer.
And yeah. So I really... And it was very... It was kind of subverbal or post-verbal. I mean, I was sure. Getting up on stage and acting out and screaming and crying and doing all, you know, lots of antics. I was everything but controlled sentence writing. And that was really interesting to me at the time. I mean, it still is. I understand why I was drawn to it, but it was a big release, and also I, you know, we did craft kind of funny things. We did a couple quasi rock operas.
What was one? It was based on a Ham.
Based on Ham, the space chimp.
Okay, that's amazing. Now, is there any documentation of this anywhere?
I think someone had took some still photos, but no. Unfortunately, it's all lost. We even wrote some special songs just for the, you know, I don't know what happened to any of that. The guitarist has a lot of archives. He has a lot of tapes, so he may have something. But that was, And then we did one that didn't work as well, but it was based loosely on some Evel Knievel exploits. But so we did, I mean, we did some interesting things, and it was, you know, noise rock, art punk, whatever you want to call it. It was, you know, and it was, could be confrontational, and it could be provocative, and I really, but it was also coming from the fact that I had always loved listening to music, and
right.
So it wasn't, I was kind of stumbling into the performance part of it.
Did you?
But I'd always been the guy in my bedroom, you know, screaming into a
really?
Hockey stick, yeah, pretending yeah. it was a microphone when I was, you know, 12. So I was fulfilling some fantasy also.
Were you already at that young age listening to noise rock?
No. I was listening. I mean, the first things I listened to, I was trying to think of this yesterday. I have a very strong memory of sitting in my living room in suburban New Jersey and watching my mother do her calisthenics to Hot Rocks, the Stones record.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a good.
And she's in her, like, tights or whatever, and, like, her feet are up doing a bicycle. Uh-huh. And Street Fighting Man is blaring on the speakers, and I'm, you know, 3 or whatever. And that, to me, is a very primal memory.
It's a shame. People can't see the way you just moved your shoulders to show what she was doing.
And so that it started then.
Right.
But so you were actually enjoying that music?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I remember riding with my family, and they were playing Creedence, mm-hmm. I guess, and feeling something, like, very early. Like, this is still, like, yeah, 3, 4, feeling very connected to it. Then I remember not really knowing anything about music. I was the oldest, and I didn't really have a guide, so I kind of had to stumble on things.
Sure.
My own way. Met a kid in kindergarten who, for some reason, he was obsessed with Elvis Presley, even though it was, you know,
in kindergarten,
long after Elvis had died. But so we listened to Elvis records, and then I went to.
Well, he's very performative. I mean,
yeah,
that,
exactly. Like... I mean, you learn a lot just from that. I remember going to summer camp. I'm sorry, I'm just spilling all my.
This is the point of this.
We want.
And there was this fairly sadistic camp counselor that, you know, was very charismatic, and, you know, we all wanted to please. And he, you know, had these 2 8-track tapes that he would play all the time. And one was Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell.
Ooh, classic. Yeah.
And
classic.
The other was, oh, my God. Or no, there were 3 maybe, because the other was Supertramp.
Okay.
And there was... Billy Joel, and it was all very confusing to me. I didn't know what all any of it meant. But
how old were you?
I guess I'm now like 8 or something. But okay. I'm just trying to process it all. I don't have a teacher yet for all of this. But so then I went home, and I told my mother that I wanted the Meatloaf record and
Bat Out of Hell.
Bat Out of Hell, and she took me to the local record store, and there was, you know, it said in the window Meatloaf, and. And she said, I remember her getting very angry, saying, like, well, this is very, this could be very confusing to, say, an immigrant or someone who doesn't understand that they're not selling food here.
And huh. This is at a record store?
Yeah. I'm like, Mom, it's a record store. But she felt it was, you know, they should have been clearer about what they were selling.
It is a disingenuous name. I'll give her that. Okay.
Sweet. I've heard a similar argument about the green cross for all the weed dispensaries.
Oh,
they're
right.
Like,
yeah.
Well, maybe people go there looking for help.
Help, yeah, yeah. Right, yeah. So I remember, you know, I would memorize all the lyrics to these. I memorized all the lyrics to Bat Out of Hell when I was whatever that
12, 14.
A young child. No, younger. I think.
Oh, younger.
But there was a guy in my class named Henry Kwok, and we would, at parties, we would do the song together, Although he always made me do the woman's part.
Henry, man. Henry
yeah. was definitely dominating me in those days. This is all, and I'm thinking of this because I remember around after the Dung Beetle days, I was doing a little recording with, he was still John McClane, but Juan McClane.
Okay, yeah.
From Six Finger Satellite. And I remember doing we were just messing around. We wrote some songs in a day, and I was recording them, and he kind of just stopped.
You were singing.
I was singing. Okay. Yeah. And he played some guitar or something, and then mm-hmm. we were just making a demo or something, not for anything, just for fun. But
is this teenage years?
No. This is in our 20s. Mid to late 20s. But I remember he just stopped, and like called me into the booth and just said, I got to ask you, did you listen to a lot of Billy Joel when you were a kid?
Oh, gosh.
And I felt I had been found out, that I, you know, a shameful secret had been revealed. And it was something in my way that my phrasing, it was all there, that I had kind of the cheesiest grounding. And no matter how punk I really ever thought I could be, mm-hmm. that my DNA was deeply
piano man.
I think that's a really honest thing that probably most of us have, sort of embarrassing early things that we're trying to hide that are part
Billy
of
Joel's
us.
Joel's not that bad.
No, I mean, I actually now I admire the man.
Yeah, but if
I
you're
think
trying
there was something,
to be a noise rock.
I think there was a time when you had to play that down, but
yeah.
Now I'm comfortable with all of it, as you can tell, because I'm speaking so freely.
Do I understand the chronology right? You talked about when you went into Dung Beetle and you were sort of in love with the idea of making music with other people. There was something I read earlier where you talked about sort of getting shocked or almost mildly traumatized by the idea that the author is dead and that you shouldn't be just this sole hero and you should be part of a community. Did that lead to you saying, I should make music?
I think I wouldn't have been able to articulate it that way at the time. But yeah, I think that pushed me in that direction, or it felt like a way to go. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was having a very simplistic reaction to the author is dead, but it for me it just felt like I had been alone in a room for a long time trying to write. Mm-hmm. And
at a young age,
from
too.
A young, fairly young age. And it was really, I think I was really happy to just get in a room with some other people and be creative with them.
Mm-hmm. How did that?
In the end, I realized I'd rather be alone. But...
right, because now, 30 years later, it's...
I don't need these people.
I don't need you.
Yeah, you must have. Did your parents, because they're both writers, did they consciously guide you, or you just kind of saw what they were doing and thought, I'm mirroring this?
I think there was some mirroring. I think maybe some competition. I think, I don't know. I think that for a while I did it. I figured out how to do it to get pats on the head, you know? Mm-hmm. And then that was part of maybe doing the Dung Beetle too, was kind of turning on that.
Right.
And then I had to kind of discover what writing meant to me, for me, away from the family legacy. Mm-hmm.
You said, sorry, I feel like I'm bouncing around here too. You said earlier when you were just listening to a lot of different music, mostly that your parents were playing and or your friends, you mentioned that you didn't have a teacher yet. Was there someone later that was kind of a music teacher or somebody that showed you where the cool music was? Or
I think it was little bits and pieces along the way. So I had a friend whose brother had the Velvet Underground records, and that was a big deal. And and I remember I was walking down the street and I saw this flyer for a replacement show. And I was like, who are they? And then I went and got their records and that. And then I started, you know, reading, I don't know, whatever rock magazine, like Maximum Rock
Cream.
And Roll. Yeah, not Cream so much, but later ones. But anyway, I had to hear about different post-punk bands, and it's one of those, as you know, you hear about one thing and then that leads you to the next thing, which leads you to the next thing. And then once I was sort of hanging out with people who really knew music, I, you know, delved into it pretty quickly after that. You know, then you go back and you're listening to, you know, I mean, like when I was 17, I had no idea who Wire was. But then, right. you know, by the time I'm 19,
mm-hmm. the world.
Yeah. Like you, you can do all that pretty quickly, you know, yeah. in a way.
When did you get into the X, that Dutch band?
Yeah, I mean, I liked them. Somebody turned me on to them around that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't remember.
I was also curious. Were you in the time that you're in Dung Beetle? Were you kind of just surrounding yourself exclusively with whatever label, noise rock or post punk? Was that kind of all you were listening to at the time?
No, I think I would listen to some jazz sometimes. Mm-hmm. I would listen to old blues sometimes. But I did listen to a lot of, you know, guitar music mm-hmm. made between 65 and whatever year I was in. I would say it wasn't as wide as it should have been. It was pretty narrow because I felt I wanted to dive deep.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then when you kind of stepped away, or maybe the band was falling apart, I don't know exactly, but and you said, I'm going back to writing. Did you sort of need to stop listening to that music for a while, or did you continue with it?
I think that I continued with it with some bands that I liked, or mm-hmm. I wanted to see what they would keep doing, but mm-hmm. I didn't go to shows. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, really keep up. And yeah, for a while I just didn't want to hear any music. That's true.
Any music at all?
No, any of that kind of music. Oh, right. Yeah.
And so that's what I was wondering. What was there a particular genre you went into, or did you kind of spread out?
I didn't go deep into any genre after mm-hmm. that. I think that I just listen to what came my way, and actually, I became friends with a guy who, my friend Alex, who has written extensively about music, and I was able to share with him a lot of the rock stuff that I had picked up over the years. But he knew a lot more about the history of music and American music and folk and blues, and I was able to get a little bit more of that at that time. Like, you know, like even things like Doc Boggs or Skip James or that kind of stuff that, like, I hadn't really listened to that carefully before.
Sure.
Yeah.
What were your lyrics like for Dung Beetle? I mean, were they completely the opposite of what you've been writing in terms of fiction?
Yeah. I mean, I think that they were.
Was it like a quarter life crisis?
It was a quarter. I mean,
I've dealt with that, so I guess I was just curious.
Sometimes they were deliberately stupid.
Okay.
Sometimes they weren't. Sometimes they were deliberately cryptic. Okay. Sometimes they. Well, like that song we were just listening to. Actually, I think the chorus is "The Man Went Out,"
right?
Which was actually that line was in the movie
One
Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah, so that's where we got the chorus. And then the lyrics of that song are really about some friends who were in some bad straits. And I think that bit you were playing, the first line is, "Bleed for me, Jim. Chew your belt and try to grin.
Okay.
Heard about your friend. I guess you ain't no Samaritan." Mm-hmm. It was kind of, there were some bleak things happening around drugs and people getting hurt. And that's, I think that's where that song was. So that song was actually, that was our message song. No, that was about something. But, you know, there was also songs that would have lyrics like "Tony Danza's on Ecstasy." And that's not really pushing the music forward in any way.
Right,
but
right.
Let's see. What else were they about? Our signature song was called "Blowhole."
Okay.
And I don't know, you could probably find it. We put it out as a single.
I'll find it.
And
"Blowhole."
Yeah.
Okay.
You didn't have to repeat it.
But no W. It's BLO hyphen hole.
Okay.
And it's kind of a instrumental that then breaks down, and I make a speech in the middle of it.
A soliloquy.
Yeah. And I think I can even remember it. You'd like me to recite it.
If you are so willing, I'd be interested. I think our listeners would.
Just give you an idea of what my lyrics were like. Are you finding it?
No, I'm finding facts about some air hole in the dung beetle.
Well, that's the thing. If you Google dung beetle, all you're going to get is a lot of pictures of insects and some Scientific American articles about.
Well, when you type dung beetle band, you do get a few.
Yeah, a couple mentions.
But not blowhole. Well, let's hear the.
Well, it would be this kind of hard charging instrumental, and then it would kind of break down. And then I would say, I would be screaming it, but I'm not going to scream it.
Okay.
You can stand in the corner.
I would say, I once believed in the precepts of secular humanism, Jack. I believed that facts were lies, and that's a fact, and that's a lie, and that's a fact. And I believed that television watched back. But I found a new way to be free, motherfucker. I just paddle out as far from shore as my arms will take me, edge my board up to the dolphin, and stick the business end of my .30-06 right into his blowhole. It's just that easy. And then the band would kick in again.
Oh.
I'm amazed that you remember
all that. Yeah, I was going to say.
Because I suspect you don't get asked that often, or do you?
No, it's been about 20 years.
How in the world? How did you pull that out?
Some things stay in the mind.
Well, you probably sang it a lot.
I performed it many times. Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you.
So that was about killing a dolphin with a shotgun.
Yeah, not peaceful. I wish I could find the original.
I was a little angry.
We'll find it later.
Yeah.
And it was, not directed at the right places.
Sure.
The poor dolphins.
Oh, they're nice.
I meant the dolphin fish, not the, just kidding.
The football team? Yeah. What do you go to now for music? Do you put on records? Do you just have music on your phone or computer?
I still have a bunch of old records, but I don't really have a working turntable. Oh. Really, the cool vinyl fetishist that I'd like to be. I like to just sit in a room with the music going, but it's hard sometimes when everyone's saying, "Dad, turn it off. It sucks."
Right.
Well, I know, like, your son's into hip hop, right?
He is. Although I heard some Nirvana coming from his room the other day. So, okay. So he's
classic rock. What's now classic?
Branching out into classic rock. So we'll see. But I try to, I try to listen to some of the stuff he listens to stay up on that. And but yeah, I listen to stuff on my phone and but everything I have, pretty much any kind of record I have, I can get it on my phone. So it's kind of and I don't really listen to music when I write.
I was gonna ask that. No, you don't.
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, I could do that more, but I just get too distracted.
Right.
At this point, I don't have enough focus.
Do you put on music like beforehand, just get yourself
sometimes,
in the mental
yeah,
space?
I do that sometimes. Yeah, sometimes I do that. And I like to play music when I'm just doing chores or whatever.
Sure.
But it's strange because it used to be such on all the time in my life, and now I think my life doesn't have it as much, which is a shame.
I know what you mean. I'll see what I call young. Anybody in their 20s, to me, feels very young. And they put speakers on their bike and they have music while they're biking, like a bicycle. And that, to me, is so crazy.
Really?
I don't need music that constantly. But I know what you mean. That sort of like, it sounds so dumb to say.
I have to walk from this side of the room to the other. What song am I going to put on?
Well, that's how I am. I constantly need a distraction.
Yeah. You still do?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, I can't deal with a block with my own thoughts.
Really?
I need something to take me out of myself.
I have seen, when you walk your dog, do you have headphones on?
Yeah. Are you mental?
I think I've seen you doing that. I would never do that.
Why? Why would you not?
I like the sounds of whatever is in the world. That must sound, I feel like that sounds so smug, but it's, I know you do.
Okay, yeah. I have a dog.
Also, yeah, does your dog listen to music?
He does. Yeah. My dog enjoys music, yeah.
Can you tell? Yeah, I guess you can.
Well, not when I have my headphones on, but yeah. I can tell when, yeah, I play music, and he's an older man now. He's 11, but yeah, he likes music. Beckett, his name's Beckett Longsnout.
Nice.
He's got the long snout. But yeah, he likes music. Was that the question?
Yeah, that was his question.
But this does kind of get to something, and when I say it does, I mean it doesn't at all. But your prose is musical in terms of staccato, and in terms of, I mean, you don't use a lot of conjunctions. I mean, I guess it kind of depends on the work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it would be very distracting to listen to something else while you're kind of writing the way you write. I mean, was that something that you just stumbled upon, or have you always had a lyrical ear, as the people say?
Well, I didn't realize that you could do that in writing until a certain point.
Is this like Gordon Lish?
Yeah,
like,
that kind of thing. But also just reading a lot of the writers that he had edited or... Mm-hmm. You know, so understanding that could be a big part of it. So I think for me, it was reading someone like Barry Hanna,
mm-hmm. okay.
and some other writers, Grace Paley, just people where you hear them doing kind of musical composition on the page with words, and it's not, they're still telling stories, and they still have characters, and they still, you know, scenes and things are happening, but every sentence is an opportunity to create some kind of sonic magic, and that when I discovered that's actually what won me back to writing in some ways. I mean, I'd read some of that stuff before, but when I really saw how if you worked hard you could possibly get there,
mm-hmm.
or get close to doing something in that realm, that really excited me. So yes, and I think that with, especially with short stories, I was interested in kind of not replicating what a song would be like, but sort of the same idea of, you know, you have a limited amount of time, you have to manage every moment, there's this compression going on.
Mm-hmm.
I always think of a short story as more like a poem than like a longer piece of prose, and also like a really great pop song or something that, you know, you get in and out and it has this one gathering effect. So I think that those things, the relationship between writing fiction and music to me has been central. It's been the, you know, more important than, I mean, film is definitely there and of course life, but music in terms of thinking about rhythm and thinking about the acoustic properties, that for sure, that's been a huge part of my development.
But it's just refining your ear too. It's not like in a short story you're going for a certain amount of alliteration or something
No,
it's just something that you've honed essentially.
Yeah, it's like being a musician with an ear.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. It's you can, as you develop your ear, you can more quickly ascertain whether something's good or not, or is too much or not enough, or works or doesn't
work. Right.
All of that stuff, and it's all very lightning quick after a while.
Now, but you were in like Ron Silliman and like Language Poets. And
I read a lot of that stuff in college. Yeah.
Which kind of you went away from later on, or did
I was interested. So I think probably some of it lingered in
right.
me, or still does, but, that stuff was interesting to me, but I, you know, then I wanted to go scream in a band after that, after reading too much language poetry.
Sure.
Charles Bernstein, that stuff. Yeah,
he just won the Bohlungen Prize.
I saw that. Yeah,
yeah, I like him a lot.
Yeah,
I'm a
great
poet, so
yeah, he's great.
I guess one of the things I was curious about too, you've talked a little bit about the kind of how do you say the word performativity? How do you say that?
That sounds good.
Yeah,
I'm gonna
the performativity of writing.
I mean, how, you know, you obviously, you are comedic. I mean, or some of your work is.
Yeah.
And it has to have a certain, I guess, how do I want to phrase this? If it's not set up right, it won't land. And sometimes that is the joke, if it's not set up right. How do you deal with that? Is that just kind of something, what does that mean, I guess, being, because I read interviews where you kind of talk a little bit about that.
I don't know. I think that there, for me, there are different stages. So there's one part where it's that initial act of composition where it is this improvisation.
Right.
And you are in, you are in the moment, and you're in this act, and you're kind of performing this speech act, this word act or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that gets it on the page. But then after that, you actually have the best of both worlds, because you get to improvise and then you get to fix it. Which,
right.
Like, say, a musician who's, you know, a jazz musician who's just, either it works that night or it doesn't, and people mm-hmm. are in the audience. You don't have to show it till it's working. So
sure.
So I guess all I meant was that there are these different stages, and that's that. I need that energy and that for that first stage, but then getting everything to land right and all of that for me, and I'm not saying that's true of every writer. Some writers can do it all in one shot, but for me, it's endless revision. It's constant tinkering. I always say I hate writing. I like rewriting. I mean, I really like to just sit there and play with it till everything lands right, till the texture is there and the rhythm is there and the meaning is there. I mean, all of that has to all kind of be together.
Do you read it out loud to yourself as you're working on it?
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more like a mumbling to myself.
Sure.
I knew this guy who used to read everything out loud to his cat.
Oh, God.
And he felt if the cat was sort of looking at him attentively,
well, there you
he
go.
Was doing something right.
It's so perfect, because the cat of all the animals will give the least response.
Right, exactly.
You
really got to work hard for that. Yeah.
As you've grown more successful, though, has the improv felt more weighted? I mean, you have it's different than when you were writing your first short story collection as compared to your late, you know, your this is your fourth novel, right? Hark's your
fourth novel, yeah.
I mean, has it felt like there's more on this improv, or is it feel the same kind of the whole way through?
Well, I mean, that I'm still just trying to, it's all in the service of making the best book I can.
Right.
So, I mean, whether I feel pressure doing on that or pressure in revision,
it's
all, it. I mean, if there's pressure, it's the pressure of writing, trying to write a good book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know it's kind of a cliche, but you do at a certain point feel the pressure is about wanting to branch in a new direction or you know, write something as good as your last thing. That's where it's internal pressure.
It's internal, but it's not necessarily outside. Did you, when you were younger, ever talk to your parents about writing? I mean...
Yeah. I mean, my dad was a sports writer. He's still alive. He's a sports writer.
Uh-huh.
He's retired mostly, but he still does some work. And my mom passed away a while ago. But they both were journalists who also, at certain points, wrote novels. And my dad wrote some young adult novels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw them working at home a lot. And it was never strange to me to think that someone could have a job where they were at home writing. And that was like probably the best gift
mm-hmm.
I got was that was not some alien idea. That was
sure.
And then we didn't. I think that I would sometimes show them stuff and they would encourage me and say, you know, that's good. But we didn't really have too many nuts and bolts conversations about it. It was sort of learn by example.
Sure.
More. But I did learn, I mean, I was always fascinated by their industry talk, like when they talked about agents or editors.
Oh.
Like that was happening at the dinner table. I remember one time I didn't understand that like an agent had a lot of clients. So my dad came home once and said, I fired my agent, and I burst into tears.
Oh, gosh.
Because I imagine the guy like out on the street with a paper cup.
He's just one client, and that was all.
It actually sounds sort of ideal if it was just one-to-one like that.
It would be nice, yeah.
Yeah.
But you were indoctrinated from a young age, even if it was kind
of a house full of books. Implicitly. Yeah, it was a house full of books, people talking about writing, people writing. I mean, and sure, I mean, I showed them stuff and they would say, you know, I think like one time they said, you know, well, this is really purple, but that's okay, just keep going, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So there was definitely encouragement to do it, at least not necessarily as a career, but as a pastime.
How did they feel about when you stopped and went into music?
Actually, I remember my dad said, well, maybe you'll write about this someday.
Did he really? That's awesome.
He knew it'd be a phase.
I don't think he... Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to a friend who was recalling a show that Dung Beetle played at the Knitting Factory. And my parents had split up, but like my dad was in the one corner of the room mm-hmm. cringing, and my mom was in the other corner of the room cringing. Well, like I was, you know, on the stage screaming and crying and, you know, the band was going. And I guess they were just like hoping that the phase would end soon.
Wow. That's
understandable.
But you were in the band for 3 years, right?
Yeah. I mean,
that's a while.
Even longer.
When you're
yeah,
young,
yeah.
that's a lifetime,
that's,
right?
That is.
I mean, that's the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Like you did it 2 months ago. You're doing it for the rest of your life. No,
I never thought of it as a phase when I was doing
well,
it.
Well, right. Yeah. No, I know. Yeah. I mean,
the thing that I knew was going to end it for me was that I was not a musician.
Okay.
And that's like, I learned a little guitar and could, you know, contributed a couple songs musically, but really I wasn't good enough to play on stage. And I was not a good musician. And so whatever else, I was bringing other stuff to it. But in the end, like I couldn't really keep going on and forming different bands and make a life of it because I wasn't really one of them.
Right.
You know? And I mean, and this was where like knowing people like Juan McLean or James Murphy, like they were musicians.
Who could?
And they could make a life of it because they were in their medium.
Mm-hmm.
I was not really in my medium. I was in a place I loved, but I didn't really have the facility.
Did you realize that right away, or did it dawn on you slowly?
Well, I knew that I wasn't much of a musician right away. I just didn't know how far you could go without being one.
Well, you were the lead singer, too.
Yeah.
It's not like you were just standing up there cowbelling it.
No.
I mean...
No, but I mean, it's not like I could, like, if it really came down to it, it's not like I could sing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a different era.
Exactly.
Like...
No, I think that it was because I came from a place where I'd been in control as a writer in a room. Like, it's all my world. I call the shots. In that world, I couldn't really call any shots after, you know.
Right.
I couldn't really contribute the way I wanted to. I could say, oh, make it sound like this, you know, or
right,
or here I'm gonna hum it for you, you know that.
Yeah.
But I couldn't. There was a point where, I guess for me anyway, that I wouldn't be viable in the long run
mm-hmm.
as a in the music world.
By the time you had that
and the other side of it was, I had no real technical facility, so it's not like I could have then, you know, really learned how to produce music or do that part of it. So I was both like horrible with the machines and like not good with music. But
well, okay. Very self-critical. But by the time that you came to that realization, though, were you ready to get back into writing? I mean, it was something that you...
Yeah, and I think that I had given myself time to figure out what words now audible again.
Sure.
could mean for me.
Right. Do your children have any interest in writing at this point? I don't know if they're too young, but I mean, they must see you hanging out in a closed room and then eventually leaving the room with something, hopefully, that...
my son, not so much. My daughter has you know, done some writing. I think she's more in that vein, but... I definitely don't want to push any of that stuff, especially, you know, at that age.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You weren't pushed either, though, right?
No,
you came
not at all.
Naturally,
yeah.
I was wondering, I read somewhere that because you're teaching full time, that the bulk of your writing happens in the summer.
Yeah.
And you'll produce some short stories during the year when you can. Is that weird every June or whenever your school term ends to come back into it? Do you need some time?
I try to stay connected to it enough that it's not a clean slate every time. It's more like if I'm working on a novel, I've been going into it and working on it, but I haven't been able to get those, you know, 5-6 hour days every day of the week kind of chunks that I need to get the work done. So I guess I spend the school year staying connected to it and thinking about it and playing with it if it's a long thing, or writing stories here and there, and then really plunging in the summer. But yeah, it takes a little bit of time to get back into the rhythm for sure.
Yeah.
It's a thing. But I mean, I don't know if it's just the teaching. It's teaching and family. And
right.
I always say, you know, I have three things. I have my family, I have my teaching job, and I have my writing projects. And I can always do two out of the three well, but I can't do three out of the three. And I'm never going to, like, push the family part away.
That's good. That'll be a problem.
Yeah. So it's always going to be either, you know, one of them in the family or the other one. Yeah.
That's a good lesson for life, I think.
Yeah.
Because I struggle with that too. I have a wife and a kid, and I have to work to support myself, but then I have my creative projects, and one or the other takes
those are the attention. Two you have to choose from. You're not choosing. Yeah, you can't.
Yeah.
But when you first started teaching, was it hard to make that distinction? Or were you like, I want to write, I'm working on this, I'm hustling, like, I don't want to grade, or, you know what I mean? Or were you naturally kind of, once you saw your students?
Well, don't forget he's going up for tenure, so we have to make sure.
Okay, so.
Yeah, that's right. I can't.
No comment.
No, I'm not saying this for the tenure committee. I really do love the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff around it that's can be annoying, but in the classroom, I feel very happy. I'm basically around smart people talking about what I am interested in, you know, and what they're interested in. We're all here because we want to talk about books or talk about writing. So that seems to me a fun job.
Sure. Yeah. So it invigorates you kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I think that even if I didn't have to teach, if I had some other form of income, I would still probably teach a little bit. I wouldn't teach as much as I do, but I would teach a little bit just to stay connected and stay in a conversation.
Yeah, my kid's kung fu teacher says this to me constantly. He says, I learn more from these kids than they're learning from me. Do you feel that way?
Well, that's a cliche.
Is that
right?
A cliche? I mean, sorry.
Yeah. Come on. I mean,
but coming from kung fu, it's this huge muscular guy and these tiny little scrawny kids. It sounded cool.
Well, then, but he didn't mean I learned more kung fu from these kids than.
No, I think you're right.
You have a bad kung fu teacher. Yeah. Is what we're really getting down to here.
So I didn't even know you could do that.
Maybe he's like a yellow belt.
I'm just getting into this kung fu thing, but I'm teaching.
I'm just tall. That's what I'm really.
He is tall.
Yeah, and he's probably older, and he's just okay. I don't. What was your question?
Obviously, a bad one.
Yeah. I wasn't bad. Now I feel bad.
I do. Yeah, you do learn from them, or you learn from the conversations you're having. You learn what you're thinking. It helps you. Formulate your thoughts on particular issues in the field.
Yeah, I could imagine also just keeps you, not that you're old, but it keeps you connected to some younger views, right?
Well, but it's community too. You were in the band, you wanted to get away from just kind of sitting around in a room alone, and now you do that, but then don't you have...
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, what it is, and it's, I think, I feel like I've always been this way, is I really want to be alone for a while, and then I want to come out and I want to be with people for a while, and then I want to go back in the room and be alone. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so that's, I try to find the balance for that.
Sure. And if you have if you have invested students, I mean, it must be amazing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Were you listening to anything on the airplane over? Or did you fly over here from Seattle?
I flew down from Seattle today.
Yeah.
That was a 10-minute flight.
Oh yeah, of course. What am I talking about? So that's like listening to the stewardess and then you land.
Have you done that flight? It's yeah.
I've taken the train because it's such an easy train ride.
How long is the train?
It's 3 hours, yeah. But it's
I should have done that.
It's so convenient.
The plane is hilarious because you reach altitude and then they say, "We will now begin on descent." Right.
Well, yeah, it's a short flight.
You spend longer in line than you do in the
air. Actually, we spent a while on the tarmac trying to get to a gate. That was what we I flew from New York to Seattle the other day. And that, was I listening to anything?
Yeah, what do you do on those long flights? You read or what's your current?
I was reading a little bit. Uh-huh. And then I watched some movies.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, which is a great opportunity to see all the bad stuff that's out there right now.
Yeah, on a flight, I'd prefer the easiest movie. I don't want anything
too interesting. I watched the remake of Papillon. Did you?
Oh, I saw a trailer for it.
The remake of what?
Papillon.
You ever see that?
It's a 60s movie?
Yeah, with the original had Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman as prisoners on Devil's Island, the French penal colony. Mm-hmm. They didn't really update it, not that you would update it, but they didn't really do anything new with it. They kind of just followed the old script. I guess because the old script was based on the book he was a real guy who escaped and wrote a book about it. But
interesting.
Did you enjoy the movie?
No, not really.
Okay. Yeah, since we're kind of digging. Guess last couple questions. Do any of your books have certain bands or certain songs or anything that kind of like ties them together? By any chance? I mean, there's some things that were in your life that, I mean, you...
Well, there is a band that appears in a couple different books.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
They're kind of a... They're a bad band. I mean, a kind of really mediocre band that came out of... I think they're mentioned at first in a book called Homeland. And they were a band that made it out of the high school and had, like, a minor radio hit. And they were called Spacklefinger.
Right.
And
Okay.
And I think they play at the reunion at the end of that book. And then I think I always have like maybe a Spacklefinger reference in my subsequent.
I love the name.
It's a very euphonious / dissonant name. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But nothing other, but no like Velvet Underground for the ask. Like it was nothing like that. You were listening to something,
even if
it didn't directly come into it. Like, you see what I mean? Kind of just like
I think that there have been times when I will listen to something over and over during a period when I'm writing, and it probably in some way influences that section of the book or something. Is that more what you mean?
That's kind of what I meant. I didn't necessarily mean directly, although that was welcome, but just like I was listening to just a lot when I was writing.
Right.
Subject Steve. I don't, you know, I'm just making that up, obviously, but yeah.
Maybe he was.
But you didn't write the subject.
Okay, there we go. So that's the crux of interviewing yourself. That you get into outright lies.
I don't know if I can name, but yes. Yeah. I mean, and what'll happen is I will be like, you know, I've been listening to whatever this one record over and over for the last week while I've been writing this section. And is this section this way? Because I have to ask myself, should I like now listen to some other stuff? And then not necessarily listening while I'm writing, but listening while I'm taking my breaks and listening while I'm doing the dishes, thinking about the work and listening.
Okay.
And like, is that, am I being, I have to ask myself sometimes if I'm like listening to this, you know, to that shit robot song too many times, is that affecting the rhythm of this section?
Right. And affecting it maybe in a way that's not.
Well, it's not bad or good. It's just, is it, you know, is this really what I want to do? Or is this just, am I a slave to the rhythm?
Is that a common ritual that you'll listen to the same record or even track?
I get a very obsessive like that. I have to listen to like one song 30 times and then I'll never listen to it for, you know, I won't listen to it for years. But
can you do that when your family's home?
Well, that's what headphones are for.
Right? Yeah, smart.
But yeah, that is, it's true. I don't, yeah, I can't really put on a playlist. Like, I just, I'll just go dive deep into a song until I feel like I understand every moment of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm sick of it. But that just, but I mean, I do that with short stories and books too. I mean,
well, it seeps into the writing, even though I would never know reading the story, yeah, what you were, but yeah, you know, yeah, and you wonder sometimes, is this taking over?
Or, yeah, exactly. And like, would it be different if I, you know,
uh-huh.
And so, I mean, if it's good, then it's fine. If right. It, you know, but if I'm having trouble with it, then I have to ask myself, is it the music? That's one question. Is it the music I've been listening to?
Mm-hmm. Huh.
You could write the band a letter like, you guys ruined my chapter.
Right.
So, a little. I guess you want to end reading a page or two of Hark?
Yeah, I could. I don't have a copy.
I've got a copy.
I'll just read the very beginning, I guess. Unless, maybe I should read something else.
I should have marked it down. There were passages that I wanted you to read, but I didn't write them down.
Do you remember like what they...
There was one passage that I love where you described, what's the guy's name?
Fraz. Yeah.
Walking with the two kids.
Oh, it's a school?
Yeah, and one of them mentions the Twin Towers in prehistoric times.
Oh, yeah. I think I could find that.
Okay. That one had, I laughed out loud.
Fraz walks the twins to school, merges with the stream of other neighborhood fathers and mothers and nannies and kids, all of them bobbing along the avenue, sunlight catching on backpack zippers, briefcase hasps. The twins babble, shout, shove each other to the sidewalk. Who are the Illuminati, Daddy? David says. Why do they have lizard heads? Who told you about that? My phone told me. Daddy, Lisa says, can I get a keytar? Daddy, the Illuminati control everything. Daddy, I really need a keytar. Lisa, please, didn't we just buy you a guitar? That's not funny, Daddy, and I played it already. I need a keytar for my new band. We're called the Nameless Yeast. Daddy, tell me about why lizards. Shut up, David. Daddy, keytar. Daddy, wait, you're not listening. Shut it, I'm talking to him. Fine, you fucking... Hey, Fraz roars. The twins freeze in infrequent delight. A woman with a stroller watches from across the street. She's been put on Earth to witness his firm, sensitive parenting. Listen, guys, you can't do this. I'm going to answer your questions in order. David, I do believe in certain cabals, but the Illuminati stuff is a hoax. Don't bother with it. The real evil is right in front of you. Just look at the political situation, not to mention the economic situation. Lisa, did you say the Nameless Yeast? Yes, I did, Daddy. Daddy, David says, you know how in ancient times the Nine Tower and the 11 Tower were exploded? Why did the lizard heads do that? They didn't, and there's no they. I mean, no lizard heads. There is a they, but they have regular heads, I'm pretty sure, and we'll discuss the keytar later. What? Look, we're here. The witness has vanished. Fraz leaves the twins at the school gate. He used to escort them inside, ease coats from their shoulders, kiss them goodbye. He misses it now, the tenderness before the day's mauling began. But his kids don't want him lurking at the threshold of their homeroom. He'll never know classroom drop-off's flood of fondness and relief again. He's not the type to get divorced and start a new family. If Fraz and Tova split, he would probably never even get to sleep with another person in his lifetime, unless he paid for the pleasure. But he'd have to save a lot of money, cut corners, eat cat food for months. Some men do exactly that. Or no, they don't. But Fraz would. That's the sickness right there.
That was great. Thank you. Yeah, I really like that he can deal with all of their interruptions and asking and begging, but once a bad word comes, like, okay, this all stops. I can recognize that. Anything else?
No, I think. Thank you so much. Good?
Thank you. Yeah. All right. This was fun. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you, Sam. All right.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com.
You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.